Okay. So I'm at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and I'm going to be talking about aplastic anemia, MDS, and PNH. Fanconi anemia is a separate situation, and I know that there are physicians who work with the foundation who have an expertise in this, so if there's somebody here who has a question, we can refer that to someone else. The definition of bone marrow failure, I would say, is a low number of circulating cells in the blood due to a decreased number or function of the stem cells in the marrow. And the cases I'm going to be talking about in adults are acquired, not inherited, and unlike Fanconi anemia, are not passed down to one's children. So when we talk about low numbers of circulating blood counts, this is in common to the three bone marrow failure syndromes that we're going to be talking about. Low red counts are called anemia. A low platelet count is called thrombocytopenia. And a low number of granulocytes are called granulocytopenia or neutropenia. And this last point is a little bit confusing because there are many words all have the same meaning. Neutrophils, granulocytes, polys, PMNs, okay, or polymorphonuclear leukocytes. These all refer to the same thing, which are the pus-forming type of white cells. And I should be clear that white cells in the blood are a little bit like the chess pieces on a chessboard, in that if you look at them from a distance, they all look the same. But in fact, when you look up close, they have different functions. So you have your king and your queen, and you have pawns and rooks, knights. And of the white cells I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to focus in on this type of cells, the neutrophils, granulocytes, and the polys. So this is a micrograph picture of the bone marrow, which is comprised of fat cells here, as well as cells that produce the blood. This is a red cell. This is what a neutrophil looks like. It has a segmented nucleus. The nucleus is the dark material in the middle of a cell. And these are the platelets that plug up holes in the blood vessel. And these are released from the marrow into the bloodstream. This is what they look like in the bloodstream. This is the neutrophil. These are red cells here. These are the platelets. And this is a different kind of white cell called the lymphocyte, which I'll be talking about at the end of the talk. This is the type of white cell that fights viral infections, okay? And the neutrophil tends to fight fungus and bacterial infections. The lymphocytes are needed for long-term immunity. But the neutrophils are required for immunity on a day-to-day basis. And one can do well for a while longer with low lymphocytes than with low neutrophils. So when your doctor tells you you have low blood counts, he or she is reading off something that looks like this. This is the report of a complete blood count. And I always encourage my patients to get their complete blood count or CBC results, look at them, and try to figure out what it means. And the more you look at these, the more of a feel you'll get for what this is. And this is from one of my patients. And it's all in alphabet soup abbreviations. The WBC is the white blood count, okay, and it's at the top here. And usually in parentheses, they tell you what the normal range is. And here they tell you the units that it comes in. This is actually 2,500 per microliter of blood. Then you usually get the indices, the indexes of the red cells. And there are several ways of describing the concentration of red cells in the blood. Similar to the white blood count, you can do a red blood count, say how many red cells are in a microliter of blood. A microliter is a millionth of a liter of blood, a drop that you would just barely be able to see. And here you see it's about the same, only you might notice that instead of 1,000 per microliter, it's in millions per microliter. So there are actually about 1,000-fold increased red cells compared to white cells in a drop of blood. Okay, and here this one is also low. the hemoglobin is a little bit different, but really tells you the same thing. And doctors usually talk about hemoglobin rather than red blood count. The hemoglobin is not so much the number of red cells, but the concentration of hemoglobin, which is the protein that carries oxygen in the blood. And you can see here that it's also low. The hematocrit also tells you something about the red blood count and the hemoglobin concentration. This is the percent of blood by volume that's the red cells. So here, if you look at it, it's a percentage. 26% of the volume of blood is the hematocrit, is the red cells. These in this, and it's low in this patient. Now, the one thing that's high in this patient is the MCV. This stands for the mean corpuscular volume. And it tells you a little bit about the size of the red cell. Okay, red cells are supposed to be within a certain size distribution. And here you can see that it's elevated, 113, the upper limit of normal being 98. And it's very common in bone marrow failure syndromes for the MCV to be elevated. The MCHR will skip. And here's the platelet count, 72,000, also in thousands per microliter, similar to the white blood count units, and it is also low. Now, the differential is a measure of, or a breakdown of the white blood count, and it's actually a little bit like looking at that chessboard and saying, okay, how many pawns do we have, how many rooks, how many knights, is the queen there, etc. So the first thing you look at in the differential is the neutrophil count. And it's actually as a percentage here, okay? And it tells you, okay, 60% of these white cells are the neutrophils. And then lymphs, monos, you don't really have to know about eosinophils or basos. They're usually present in small numbers. And what's confusing is that the neutrophil can also be abbreviated in some reports as PMNs or polys. And that's why it's a little bit confusing, but it's all talking about the same thing. Then further down, what they do is usually they multiply this number by this number and give you this number down here. So here, instead of saying, all right, 50% of the pieces on the board are pawns, they'll actually tell you exactly how many pawns are on the board. And you can see here that the way they get this number is by multiplying 2.5 by 59% or 0.59, and you get 1.5. And this is actually not a bad neutrophil count for somebody with bone marrow failure syndrome, but it's still at the lower, it's still a little bit low. The reticulocytes we'll talk about a little later. These are the percent of red cells that are the new young red cells. Usually, they are low in aplastic anemia and in MDS, and oftentimes elevated in PNH. And this is actually from a patient with PNH. So Mikhail told us a little bit about what happens when you have low blood counts. Anemia, your organs don't get enough oxygen, and for all intents and purposes, the main concern is that if the person has underlying heart disease, their heart may not be getting enough oxygen when they are anemic. A young, healthy athlete could tolerate a low red cell count much better than an older person with heart disease. The platelets plug up the holes in the blood vessel. When the platelets are low, you get bleeding, bruising, and problems with surgery. Neutrophils, these are the pus-forming white cells, and when they are low, one is prone to bacterial or fungal infection. And this is actually, when this occurs, it's a medical emergency. So if you have a low neutrophil count, and you think you have an infection, that is, you have any fever at all, or any sign of infection, such as a cough with sputum or pain on urination or a rash, then this becomes a medical emergency. Other problems when the neutrophils are low are mouth sores and slow healing. So how do we treat this? Well, anemia can be treated with transfusions. Platelets can be treated also with transfusions, and we avoid situations that would make the matter worse, such as aspirin, Motrin, other drugs like that that have an effect on the platelet. We avoid those. We also may have to modify certain activities if the individual has a low platelet count and they're playing ice hockey. That might not be a good idea. When the neutrophils are low, when there's a fever, you have to treat with broad-spectrum antibiotics. A couple of pills of penicillin won't do the trick. You really would need to be admitted to the hospital for broad-spectrum antibiotics, immediate medical attention. To try to prevent infections in people who have low neutrophils, we tell our patients to avoid raw fish or meat, not to have a rectal examination because that's really the part of the body that has the highest concentration of bacteria. We try to avoid rectal thermometers or suppository pills for the same reason. And to the extent that you can avoid fungal spores, those are present all over, but when the counts are really low, if somebody has a really low neutrophil count, we tell them to not chop their own wood because that's known to increase those fungal spores in the air. Now, I live in New York City, and if somebody's chopping their own wood, they're probably going to be arrested by the Parks Department. But there are places where this is important. So what I've said so far is common to all three diseases. And you can see here that they have areas of overlap. And I'm going to show you how they're different and then bring them back together again. So when we do a bone marrow examination, we want to look at a number of things. But the first thing we want to know is, are there a lot of cells there, or is there a lot of fat there? And this is what a normal marrow looks like for a middle-aged person. You can see fat, and the pink stuff are the cells. Fat shows up white on this. This is hypocellular marrow, meaning not enough cells, too much fat. Okay, now hypo means not enough. Hyper is the opposite. It means too much. And this is a picture of somebody who has too many cells. So there isn't any fat in here. It's all cells. And this is, again, in comparison to what I showed you before, hypocellular, not enough. So in aplastic anemia, it is really always, to some extent, hypocellular, not enough. In MDS, it is really, by the FAB definitions, either normal or hypercellular. Okay? Either normal or too much. If you have hypocellular marrow and MDS, this may be one of those areas of overlap. And we actually call this hypocellular MDS. You may hear that. And it's possible that a person could actually have features of both these diseases. In PNH, it could be any of the above: hypocellular, normal, or hyper. Now, when a bone marrow exam is done, oftentimes a tube of marrow is sent to look at chromosomes. And we usually have 23 pairs of chromosomes. That's a total of 46 chromosomes. And they're arranged by size. And this is a man. He has one X and one Y chromosome. And you see here, the big ones are here, the small ones are here. And they're in pairs. This individual in the bone marrow has an extra copy of chromosome 6. Okay? So this is an abnormal set of chromosomes. Now, in myelodysplastic syndrome, there are abnormalities in the chromosomes about half the time. In PNH, this happens occasionally. This is actually one of the studies that was funded by the foundation. About 23% of the time we found abnormal chromosomes in PNH. In aplastic anemia, this occurs rarely. Sometimes a patient will have aplastic anemia. It looks just like aplastic anemia, but they'll have that abnormal chromosome that I showed you before, and then they'll be called hypocellular MDS for that reason. Now, this is a somewhat different situation. The first situation I showed you was just one chromosome that was abnormal. Here, in one cell, a lot of different chromosomes have abnormalities in chromosome 3 and 5 and 7 and part of 13 here. There are abnormal chromosomes all in the same cell. When this occurs, it is usually seen in myelodysplastic syndrome and would make the patient. So what I showed you before here, that you could have abnormal chromosomes in any of these, but if there's more than one abnormality in the same cell, it usually means that we're talking about myelodysplastic syndrome. Myeloblasts are the early cells that we saw in the last presentation that create another copy of themselves before giving rise to more mature cells that go into the blood. And these are pictures of myeloblasts. And you're supposed to have myeloblasts in the bone marrow, but not in the blood. That's the normal situation. And in the marrow, they're supposed to be less than 5% of the total cells in the marrow. In myelodysplastic syndrome, oftentimes you have more than 5%, and those would be the RAEB or RAEB-T designations that you heard about. In PNH, they are almost always normal, that is less than 5%, and in aplastic anemia. And if someone were to have more than 5% myeloblasts in PNH or aplastic anemia, then they would be thought of having really two disorders. They would be thought of having PNH and MDS, or aplastic anemia and MDS. By definition now, when more than 20 or 30% of those cells in the marrow are those myeloblasts, then we say that that's actually become a leukemia. Now, these are slides of a bone marrow from a patient with myelodysplastic syndrome. And I already mentioned that hypercellular marrow is typical in myelodysplastic syndrome. And you heard about the ring sideroblasts. These two are specific for myelodysplastic syndrome. But there are other abnormalities that you can see in MDS, but also in the other disorders. So you see here that the nucleus, which is the center of the red cell, is also like fried eggs, with the yolk being the center. They're supposed to look like fried eggs. The center is supposed to be completely round. But you see here that these cells have nuclei, which are not completely round. They're sort of more popcorn shape. And you can see this in myelodysplasia, typically, but also in PNH and aplastic anemia. Multinuclearity, where you have two yolks per egg, so to speak, this is the type of thing that you can also see in all three disorders. This is a finding that is more or less specific for PNH. This is the PNH clone that you'll often hear about. And red cells have proteins on the outside of them. And in PNH, a set of these proteins is missing on some of the cells. And the protein that is most important is called CD59. CD59 is shown here. These are patient. This is a normal patient, and you see here. It's sort of hard to explain what this is. This is actually a histogram, and you can see here that all of this patient's red cells have CD59 that are at least above this value here. In these two patients, there are cells that are here that have low levels of CD59. This is a PNH clone in a patient who has PNH. This finding, where only 2.5% are abnormal, would be typical of aplastic anemia. Here, where 33% don't express CD59 on the red cell, this would be diagnostic of PNH. So when your physician says, oh, we sent flow cytometry to look for PNH, this is what they're talking about. And they're looking to see whether or not all the red cells are normal or if there's a small or a large population that are missing CD59. When you're missing CD59, the red cell can break it open immediately or in a short period of time after being released from the bloodstream, into the bloodstream. Usually a red cell will last 120 days, but if you have PNH and your cells are missing CD59, they might last only 10 days. And because the red cells break open early and sometimes all within a short period of time, they can release their hemoglobin into the bloodstream, and it gets into the urine and it turns the urine dark. This is actually where the name of the disease, PNH, comes from, paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. Hemoglobinuria just means dark urine due to the presence of hemoglobin. And one of the quirks of this disease is that the urine often looks darkest in the morning, and then by the end of the day, clears, turns to be a normal color. So that's actually where the term nocturnal hemoglobinuria comes from, and paroxysmal meaning it doesn't happen all the time. Sometimes it's worse than others. So let's talk about red cells that are missing CD59. The way I define these diseases, in MDS, this does not occur. If the person has red cells that are missing CD59, I would say that they have instead PNH, with only some rare exceptions. PNH, yes, by definition, you have these cells that are missing CD59. In aplastic anemia, it depends how hard you look. If you're looking for this, okay, most patients with aplastic anemia will have never seen this. If you look by flow cytometry, though, okay, up to 40% of patients with aplastic anemia at some point may have an abnormality on flow cytometry where you can see these cells here that don't have CD59. For most of them, they're never going to develop this kind of dark urine. Dark urine, I think I went over this. In PNH, you could say that it's defined as having this dark urine, but there are some patients who really do have PNH, they don't notice the dark urine. And one example of this is that, which I don't have on the slides, is that specific to PNH is a tendency to form a blood clot in blood vessels where you don't want to have a blood clot, say a blood clot in the leg or in the lung or in the liver. And there are patients who have PNH, who have had those blood clots, who do have the hemoglobinuria and those CD59 negative cells, but they never notice the darkened urine for whatever reason. In aplastic anemia, if you also have dark urine and it's due to PNH, then I would call this AA-PNH, a combination of aplastic anemia and PNH. Now, reticulocytes, I showed you on the CBC report, these are the young, new red cells, and you can do a special stain for them, and you can see they stain with blue crystals inside of them, and they tend to be larger cells, and they're the newer cells just released from the bone marrow. In a normal bone marrow, if you're bleeding or if you break down your red cells, your marrow would make a lot more new red cells to make up for the loss, and your reticulocyte count would go up. Commonly, in bone marrow failure syndromes, the marrow is unable to increase the number of reticulocytes. So in MDS, they're usually decreased. In aplastic anemia, also, they're usually low because the marrow is not making enough of them. In PNH, though, they can be low, normal, or even greatly increased, because oftentimes in PNH they might have their bone marrow, although it's not functioning quite right, they are able to make the increased amount of new red cells. So if somebody thinks they have aplastic anemia, but they look at the CBC report and see that they have 10% reticulocytes, then they might also have PNH. Okay, so I think I've, maybe I've confused everybody by now, I don't know. But that's what I hope questions will be for, to clear that up. So there are points in common and points distinct. And having talked about the distinct features, I also want to talk about the common features, particularly how the treatments for these diseases can be similar. So the two treatments that are would be similar for all three disorders, in some cases, immunosuppression and bone marrow transplantation. I will not talk about bone marrow transplantation right now. It's beyond the scope of this talk. I hope that later on there'll be a seminar on that. But immunosuppression is probably effective in about a quarter of the patients with MDS. Very exciting are two new drugs, one which has just been approved for MDS, and one that's coming down the pike, and also several others that I didn't have a chance to mention about MDS. And there's a new treatment potentially for PNH, which is going to be in clinical trials, which is specifically for the breakdown of red cells that occurs in PNH. But I want to talk about the treatments that are in common to these. Now, before azacitidine and D-cytidine, or I should say, D-cytidine is not yet available, before azacitidine was available for MDS, it used to be pretty straightforward. If you didn't know if the patient really had a classic anemia or MDS, or MDS or PNH, they had features of both, you could say, well, let's just treat with immunosuppression, or if they're younger and they had a donor bone marrow transplantation, and it really didn't matter so much. Now that we have treatments that are specific for MDS, but which would not be useful in aplastic anemia or PNH, such as azacitidine and D-cytidine, it's going to become more important to make the diagnosis correctly and to try to figure out if somebody is in here, which do they really have, and which of these treatments are you going to want to start first. So why immunosuppression? What does the immune system have to do with this? Well, it turns out that in aplastic anemia, probably all patients who have, all adult patients who have acquired aplastic anemia have it because their body is starting to recognize their stem cell as foreign and killing the stem cell. In PNH, this is probably true even more than 100% of the time, probably in all patients. In MDS, again, maybe 25% of the patients who have MDS have that mechanism as the cause of their MDS. So autoimmunity is when the immune system destroys the body's own tissue rather than destroying viruses or other infections. And I think we're all familiar with autoimmune diseases of other tissues, for example, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, asthma, thyroid diseases. These are conditions where the body is recognizing tissues as being foreign, your own tissues being foreign. In aplastic anemia, the target of the tissue is not the joints as it is in arthritis, but rather the stem cell in the bone marrow. And I showed you a lymphocyte in one of the early slides to distinguish it from the neutrophils. We were talking about the pieces on the chessboard. The lymphocyte is probably, or a subset of lymphocytes, are probably the bad guys in aplastic anemia, and they are the ones that are attacking the stem cell. Now, lymphocytes actually do come originally from the stem cell, so it's sort of like a kid going back and attacking his great-great-grandfather. That's sort of what aplastic anemia may be like. So immunosuppressive therapy is aimed to kill or disable the cells of the immune system that are doing this. And specifically, it's not all the lymphocytes. It's particularly probably T cells or a type of cell similar to T cells. All immunosuppressives, because they suppress the immune system, make one prone to infection. It's very hard to turn off the immune system and keep it from attacking your tissue without also keeping it from killing bacteria and viruses and doing the things you want it to do. Now, examples of immunosuppressives that kill the cells of the immune system are antithymocyclobulin, or ATG, and a drug that turns off or disables the cells of the immune system is cyclosporin. So, antithymocyclobulin, ATG, is serum from a horse. that has been vaccinated with T cells from a human being. And the horse makes antibodies to the human T cells, and these can be given to the patient. And there are several ways of giving it. At our hospital, we give it in a special dose over 4 days by a central line, okay, not by an IV into the arm, but rather into a big IV in the neck or under the collarbone. And it takes 4 days to give, and it's very effective. It has side effects. The patient can have an allergic reaction. The urticaria means hives. They can get fever, low blood pressure, their heart can race. They can, in rare cases, get an anaphylactic reaction, which is a severe allergic reaction. And the blood counts will go down for a short time after you give ATG. They come back up within a few weeks, but they go down. So you actually make things worse before you make things better with ATG. Serum sickness is also a rash, fever, that joint pain that can happen like 10 days to 2 weeks after you give ATG. And it usually gets better by itself or sometimes with steroids. So when we give ATG, we give it with steroids to prevent these reactions. And the responses are very good. This is a graph that shows what is your chance of responding to immunosuppression if you have aplastic anemia at various time points after getting the ATG. So if you get just ATG, just looking at here at 6 months, okay, about 60% of the patients who get it will have responded to it. And then if you look out after a year, about 80% of the patients at 1 year, 12 months, will have gotten better with ATG. Now, if you give cyclosporine with ATG, in the end, you get the same result, but it happens much quicker. Here, by 3 months, 70% of patients have responded to it. So what the combination of ATG followed by cyclosporine accomplishes is it speeds up the response. These are the two established immunosuppressive therapies for aplastic anemia. And they're also useful in PNH, and maybe a quarter of patients with MDS will respond to these. Okay, ATG, or ALG as it's known in Europe, Bivane, cyclosporine, also known as Sandimmune or Nerol capsules. There are other immunosuppressive therapies for other autoimmune diseases, but none have been proven to be safe and effective in the treatment of aplastic anemia. Okay, so steroid hormones, which are useful in arthritis, for example, or most autoimmune diseases, don't work in this condition. There is also some very potent chemotherapy drugs that have immunosuppressive therapies, which we now know not to be safe in patients with aplastic anemia. So when you're talking about immunosuppressive, we're talking about ATG and cyclosporine. Anything else would be in the experimental category. And I have to say that it's hard to beat an 80% success rate, probably even somewhat higher nowadays. And so any new immunosuppressive therapy is going to have to prove that it's better than 80% successful, and that's going to be hard to do. So come visit me when you're in New York, and that's it.